Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Product Coffee, a podcast where product management leaders share stories, advice, and thoughts on all things product over a cup of coffee. Grab a cup of Joe and join us to level up your product career 30 minutes at a time. Welcome to the show today. We're excited to have Adam Oliver, founder and CEO of Crafted and a seasoned product innovator. He has roots in Pivotal Labs, making a remarkable journey to founding his own company. Adam exemplifies leadership in iterative product development and efficient team dynamics. He's here to share his experience and insights, and we're just going to dive right in and talk about all sorts of fun stuff. Grab your cup of coffee and let's get going. First question, Adam, thanks for coming on. Can you walk us through your journey of how your initial interest into product to becoming the founder of Crafted? What were the key moments, decisions that shaped your journey?
Yeah, great, Kevin. Thanks for having me on the podcast this morning. I appreciate it and excited to be here. Yeah, I think along with a lot of other product management professionals, very kind of interesting path into product. You don't always know when and how you land there. But I was an engineer back in the day writing software. The enterprise I was in wanted to go launch their own startup and they had to spin out. So and that's when we got in touch through a marketing agency with Pivotal Labs. And that was my first foray into just really excellent product development skills and tools and how to do things in the modern tech world. So that was back around 2012. I was fortunate enough to jump on with Pivotal Labs and learn great extreme programming and things there. And at the time, they were starting their product management and product design practices. And when I was a client with Pivotal Labs, I basically got forced into the product management role through, hey, you can try to code with the developers and do this product role. Or what we really need you to do is just be a product manager. And then I had to go look and understand what a product manager was, what's the role, what's it all about. But I just got thrust into it overnight. And all of a sudden, like within a couple of weeks, I was no longer a developer and I was a product manager. And I was also leaving what the old world used to call like a business analyst, right? You were a business analyst and developer. Now it's okay, product management is similar to those things, but hopefully more strategic if you can get there. And so then that took me on a journey through Pivotal Labs, learning from these experts in Silicon Valley and in New York City and really honing my skills. And as Pivotal grew, I then realized I wanted to stay with growth stage companies and growth stage startups, right? Anything from seed in A rounds to private equity and high growth type of companies. But at the time, Pivotal Labs started going upstream into the enterprise, Fortune 200 space, government space. So at that point in my product management journey, I realized my passion was growth stage company, startup companies where you can really make iterative, quick decisions, launch stuff to markets, you get quick indicators of if it's working or not. So 6 years ago, I decided to jump out of Pivotal Labs and start Crafted. And we've been growing a product management or product development consultancy where we have product managers, designers, and engineers. And we just help our clients ship a lot of value. That's a high level quick story.
Wow. It's awesome. I think a lot of folks have either gone through similar journeys or are aspiring to go through similar journeys. So it's very helpful to share those kind of things. But before you got into the technology space, what were you doing?
Yeah. So I was born and raised here in Colorado, went to the Colorado School of Mines. That was back in 2004, where I got a mechanical engineering degree. When I got out in 04, I ended up taking a left turn and got into real estate and land development instead of mechanical engineering. And that was great. I really enjoyed it. Similar to technology, you're building things, you're shipping them, you see them go from nothing to people can move into homes and drive on roads that you build and things like that. But unfortunately, there was the real estate bubble of 08. And I was working a ton. I was getting further away from my engineering roots. And I was a little worried about that being young in my career. And with the real estate bubble bursting, I was like, hey, I want to get back into engineering, at least use my degree. But then again, instead of going straight into mechanical engineering, I had friends at that point in the tech space. And they said, hey, you're smart. You have an engineering mindset, even though it's not mechanical, like you can come do this, you'll learn it. And so I did, I jumped into tech and haven't looked back since. So that's been about 15, 16 years now, but it's been a great journey. I certainly enjoy being in tech where we can still build and ship something out into the world.
I love the story of having friends in those industries that just connect you at the right time with the right thing. So it's great. I've had a lot of similar experiences and it's good to hear. You mentioned one thing that I don't think we've actually talked much about on this podcast, but extreme programming. What is it? How did you use it? How has it evolved a little bit?
Yeah, good stuff. I'm glad you brought that up. So it really did change my view on tech. And it really took me from what I would call old school ways of doing tech to new school ways. So extreme programming, it came out of Kent Beck and some guys in Silicon Valley. And really the idea is you get two people working together, writing code together to solve a problem. And it's called pair programming or extreme programming. You'll hear about that. And really one of the old founders of Pivotal Labs explained it really. If you can iterate once a week with somebody, that's okay. That's better than once a month. But if you can take that iterative collaboration down to real time, you basically take those feedback loops and they go to infinity, right? Your feedback is immediate. It's not with a pull request. It's not one day later. So pair programming is just that. You get two smart engineers together typing literally on the same sets of code, right? They have two keyboards, two monitors. So it's really comfortable setup and they're just solving a problem together, building it together. And it's really interesting to see when you see it flow really well. We have found that it can work really well when it's two similar experienced people solving a problem. Two senior people will help each other come up with a better solution, or two junior people will also help each other get better. Then there's also a different way of leveraging it, which is like a senior person pairing with a more junior person where you're upskilling somebody. So that's been a great transition in the tech space and how to write code. And then we found at Crafted, it's a great way for product managers to come up with better product sets and OKRs, any of that. Product managers pairing with designers, or even any of those two disciplines pairing with engineers, right? If you can have a designer pair with your engineers to demonstrate or communicate what's going on from the Figma mockups down into the code, things speed up, they move faster, and you get more crisp solutions at the end of the day.
Thanks for the background there. And yeah, I've seen the same kind of thing. I think paired programming is something that we're more familiar with, but it's great to hear like how you all found the benefits, the variations, all of that. I wanted to talk a little bit about your experience at Pivotal Labs, that journey of joining, of leveling up within the organization and then going public. How has that experience like influenced your approach to product development and to leadership in general?
Yeah, definitely. I'll speak more to maybe the product development side first, and then we'll talk more of the IPO and the finances and leadership. On the discipline side of it, just becoming a better practitioner of product development and product management. When I say product development, the PMs, designers, engineers, shipping code, when a product manager is specific to that discipline. But by going on with Pivotal Labs, they were really experts in those disciplines. And they were like craftsmen, right? They were like tacticians that cared deeply about product management, design, or engineering. Where my experiences before that were just similar to a lot of people. You can read blogs, you can learn stuff, but you're just winging it on your own. You're trying it with a couple of people and you're blindly feeling your way through the forest of best practices. And am I doing it right? I don't know. But by joining Pivotal Labs for me, it was like, I have these experts. They've done it with a lot of clients, with a lot of companies. Some of them came from Stripe and Twitter and really reputable places. So I knew I was getting to learn with people that deeply cared about this practice and that had done it before. So it wasn't just reading Eric Ries's Lean Startup book and then trying. No, we've experimented with this a ton. And so that just gave me the benefit of like, man, if I can go soak up knowledge from those teams of great people, I'll do it for a year or two. I'll leave as a better product person and I'll go do whatever. I ended up staying 4.5 years and then started Crafted because I love the way it's done. So it's just, yeah, changed my life getting tied in with those groups of people that just care deeply about how to implement these best practices. And then as far as like the journey to the IPO, very interesting path. What I realized in that, and I think maybe some people in their 20s and 30s will realize with tech, is that a lot of emphasis gets put on stock and equity. And what I realized as you go towards that journey, you really have no control over it. And things happen along the way. A lot of it doesn't pay out. So what I would caution people to is, you know, be cautious of how much emphasis you're putting on stock as you take job opportunities. Certainly some of them can pay out. A lot of them won't. But I think there's been a trend of maybe a little bit too much emphasis there. And I just found didn't have a lot of control. They did end up having an IPO. So that was actually a success story. And yeah, there was some icing on the cake at the end of that journey. But I also you realize just how little impact you have or control over that financial situation. You're very much a passive person on the bus.
Going into something like a Pivotal that is more of consultancy agency type of work, it's contractual, right? And some of these contracts might last longer than others, but for the most part, from what I've heard, and I want to hear your experience with it, is that it's on a project based, maybe it's a year or two. It's usually what I hear from contractors is that they have a longing for a home built product that they can sit with over time and grow. Did you feel that same push pull or I love the reps that you get with that too, but yeah, what did you experience?
Yeah, exactly. None of those comments are wrong, Kevin. And I think I absolutely went into Pivotal saying, hey, I'm going to do this for a year or two. I'm going to soak up best practices. And then yes, I want to go back to a SaaS company in-house and build products. And I want to own them from start to finish. I want to see years of iteration and growth. And I think that's very true. You do get that pull with consultants. I think, like you just said, the flip side of that by going and staying deeper with consulting over a longer period of time is just the reps. You get to see a lot of breadth and depth of sizes of companies, industries, and things like that. So there's pros and cons. It certainly is one that we keep an eye on. How can we keep things fresh at Crafted so that hopefully people will stay? But I also don't blame people when they say, no, it's time for me to go back in-house. I want to own it long term. Our typical engagements with a company like Crafted are in that realm of what you said, anywhere from usually 6 to 18 months is very common. Less than 6 months is a little less common these days. And certainly getting close to 2 years, they'll probably start to hire their own teams or become self-sufficient.
Yeah.
But on the consulting side, you have to, the analogy that's commonly used is being like a surrogate mother. You get to get ready to have the baby and do all the hard work in that realm. And then when the baby is born, it's somebody else's baby and they go take care of it. And
yeah,
they have a whole different set of fun and challenges to then grow an adult. But yeah, pros and cons on both of those sides of the equation.
Now, I love the reps. Like that's something that I've found a lot of us learning better by doing rather than studying. Definitely do a heavy amount of studying. But what do you recommend for folks either? Let's say that they're at an established organization and it's not a contract, so it's a product company. What do you recommend for them to pull up the reps as much as you're doing with consulting? Is there any kind of practices they can do on the side or anything like that to continue those reps?
We often recommend either to our own teams or to people in the market is follow a lot of the thought leaders. Obviously, I think anybody that's trying to advance their career is probably doing that. So, right, like Teresa Torres and Marty Kagan and Jeff Gotthelf and stuff like that. But then what I would say is don't just read it, right? Go try it. Like it's pretty low bar to try these things. We're a big fan of Measure What Matters by John Doerr, trying to set up OKRs. He even admits it in his book, and we've seen it in real life, that the first iterations of any of these things are not good, right? You're going to screw them up. Your first roadmap at a company is going to get trashed and it's going to be mostly wrong. Your first OKRs are going to be a stab, right? And so what I would tell your teams is just go try to put together Teresa Torres's opportunity solution tree. You're going to mess it up a bit, then read her book a second or a third time or listen to her podcast and whatnot. You'll get smaller tidbits. You're like, okay, next time we do this, we can make it better. But don't be afraid to try different practices and technique and see what works. Treat your product career and your product practice within your company just like how you want to ship products, which is iterative and experimental, and then just see what works. Yep.
Absolutely. Love that. So I want to talk to you a little bit about hygiene, because I think this is something that is really critical for a product leader to have so we don't lose sight of those things over time and gives us the space to be very experimental and to try new things. So in terms of hygiene, like I think some folk maybe product operation-y type of language, but is it having roadmaps every quarter is helpful? Is it that you're launching products, you're having Pivot or Persevere meetings? What are those hygiene moments for you as a product leader that you want to make sure that your teams are doing continuously?
I'd say we occasionally recommend a couple of specific ways to do that. Like often your backlog starts to bloat, and there's all this stuff that continuously goes down the backlog and never gets attention. Some people call it an ice box and put it in an ice box or a parking lot even. And honestly, one thing we recommend, and I've absolutely done this on certain clients if they're not too freaked out by it, is just delete. Just get rid of it, yeah. Right? Like, it's scary. Some people are like, oh God, no, I got to go save a copy of that spreadsheet. That's fine. Go put it in a spreadsheet. You're never going to look at it, or just delete it. Like, in some of the...
Is there a cadence to that? What do you think of is the right cadence?
Yeah, I don't know if we've ever set like a true cadence, but it's basically when you just start to feel like, man, we're just weeding through this massive list of junk that we never do anything with. It's like in your basement. If you move something X number of times and you still never use it, just get rid of it, right? Or in your closet. If you're like, man, I'm pretty sure I'll wear that shirt again. And then 3 years later, you still haven't worn the shirt. Like, just get rid of it. So I would maybe say a couple times a year. Maybe it's like spring and fall cleaning type of thing, Kevin.
Yeah.
But I do believe it. Just delete it and get rid of it. If it is important, that's the thing we always come to. If it's important, it'll come back. I guarantee it.
Absolutely. I love that. That's such a good tip. I want to marry that with the longer term roadmaps, because some of these other organizations, you're in a product company, you're pitching a long-term roadmap for your investors, your VC fund, right? Like, now that's going to look a little different. And then how do you treat the two of deleting the backlog, but still having the strategy and vision?
Yeah, I think when you are pitching those longer term roadmaps to like investors or boards or something like that, I somewhat think maybe beyond 6 months or certainly beyond a year, it should only be a handful of very high level bullet points, right? It should be maybe less than 5 or 10. But beyond that, you can re-brainstorm those when it comes up. But to go have a 2-year roadmap in things that are 18 months out, you have a list of 100 things.
Yeah.
Like, one, it's going to change so many times before you get there. Or two, like, some of those things are going to fall off. So I just think when you look further out, it should be higher level of fidelity or higher level bullet points, and just not that many of them. So I would treat it the same way. If there's certain things that you know are on the radar out there, I wouldn't let them go, because that can cause some stakeholder misalignment. You're like, guys, we've talked 100 times that in a year and a half, we'll have cryptocurrency. Okay, keep a bullet point on the roadmap, but it shouldn't be a detailed backlog view of cryptocurrency in 3 years and something like that. So
until you're ready for it.
Yeah, exactly. Because then you're going to have to rethink it, re-solution it, like all those things when it is a priority.
Yeah, I love that. We did something called a 3-3-3. I think it's just the horizon type of roadmaps, where you have your first 3 months that is a little bit more planned and Gantted. You have the 3 quarters after that is a little bit directional, but less concrete. And then you have the 3 years, which is more visionary. Yeah, those longer term things. Right. I've seen now next laters, now next futures, right? Similar concepts. And then, but I like different ways to think of how to keep the hygiene, but also not pin yourself into a corner. And then also not, there's all these kind of things you have to be aware about with different types of stakeholders. I want to talk to you a little bit more about staying scrappy. And so in the concept of product development, what does that mean? Can you share like any specific instances where that value was true in your career or at Crafted?
When I think of teams staying scrappy, I think it falls back to the concepts and the ideas of being lean and thinking about MVPs. I know that term is a varying degree of success at the moment in the market and different thoughts behind it. But I still think it's a very valid way of thinking about things. Lean and MVPs. I think when you're bridging the gap between PMs, engineers, and designers, like staying scrappy on your problems and your solutions, right? Like, I think all three of those disciplines need a mindset of being okay letting go of some of what they think is perfect or ideal. I'll come up with a scrappy design to meet that need. I'll come up with a scrappy way of implementing the code versus the perfect way of implementing the code. So I think maybe another analogy for scrappy is like thinking like a startup, right? It's okay, we're limited time and budget, even more so than a big enterprise. So we need to be scrappy to get this to market. But I think it's still very relevant. I think as we go into next year, Kevin, with tighter budgets, tighter headcounts, it'll probably be even more important to like, how can we ship software in a really scrappy way? But not, what I don't want scrappy to be synonymous with is crappy. Right? Scrappy and crappy aren't the same thing. MVP does not mean ship crap, right? That's a bad tone that it's gotten over the last few years. I don't think any of those things are true. you can ship scrappy, lean MVP software that is a good solution for the market, right? And then you figure out how and when to iterate on that and go to the next level.
I love this topic. This is definitely top of mind for a lot of organizations. I know we've talked a lot about that skateboard versus Ferrari, those kind of five different phases of this that you can also think of, and not building a tire at a time, but actually getting the job done day one, but being scrappy with that job of how you get it done is the fun creative work. Now, I want to make that a little bit more concrete. So was there a past example in the last year or so that drums up that type of mentality, that value that you've seen, and can you speak to it?
Some of them come to mind, certainly on the engineering side of things. My team has had some conversations here. We have a pretty big enterprise client, but in the same way, they are trying to ship lean iterative software. So it's a very balanced mix of, they're not shipping their MVP scrappy solution to five people. So how do you stay lean and scrappy when it is going to get turned on for 30,000 users? And I think we had to go to there and came up to some good solutions was, how do you implement, like we had an ideal way of implementing a feature with strong architecture, the right way to write the code. And we came back with some solutions on the table that could get it done probably about 5x faster. And it wouldn't make most engineers perfectly happy, but we thought we had the assumption that it would solve the problem, would get us to market within a couple of days instead of a few weeks for a certain feature set, and then let us move on to different values. So that was one where we put our heads together. We said, it worked. If it's going to fall over and fail, then no, it's the wrong solution. But if it's just less than ideal, let's go ahead and ship the feature houses. And it just had to do with how the API was structured. And there was a more performant way to do it or a more brute force way to do it. In this situation, we took the more brute force way, but it was okay, right? It was a valid way to ship that feature in, like I said, something like 20% of the time. So that was our implementation side. On the UI UX product side, I'm trying to think of good examples. I think there it was more just like trimming scope, like looking for ways. Yes. One big one that comes up is like authentication, which is an old boring problem. But if you can solve that with one way that allows everybody to get into the system, and maybe it's not the most graceful way, or do we go implement six different paths to authenticate through six different routes? No, let's just pick the one that works for 100% of the users. Like, we know they might want to log in 10 different ways, but you know what? People can still use an email and password just fine. And then we'll add on the other ones later. So staying rigorous with our scope was important on getting things out the door.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. We talked last episode with Jake about designing the Ferrari up front. That gets our teams into some traps of having to peel back that layer and then get back, strip it down to a tire. Versus like actually spending time to design the hacky skateboard, to actually spending time to focus your energy there as opposed to designing here and then scaling it back. And some of the ways that we found, especially with enterprise development or these we call monolithic code bases, API layer abstractions, different abstractions to that code that different teams can contribute to within some safeguards or some contract, right? Which is talking about that API that you're talking about, right? And then also thinking about, it doesn't have to be 100% of users day one, right? This is really, if you're trying to prototype a concept, an idea to see if it actually solves a job, it shouldn't be 100%. Maybe it's 10 people and maybe it's very hacky. And these are your kind of innovators, your folks that are in the door day one testing it with you because they have this really desirable problem to solve. And then as you scale up, it buys you that time to then think about those more scalable features too. Those are some of the things we discussed last week as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's talk a little bit about balance teams, because you said you're an advocate for them. Do more with less. I want to talk about specific instances where this approach has significantly impacted project success and how you've seen that manifest within these companies.
That's a great question. It is something that's very core to Crafted. oh man, we need UI, UI. I'm definitely seeing that change over the last few years, but the number and the ratio of the correct number of UI, UX professionals to your balance team is still not where it needs to be. And even though I come from a product,
it's been happening.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
It needs to keep going in the better direction, right? For sure.
Why do you see that happening? Is there something underlying at these organizations and their leadership team that they're just not prioritizing it? They don't understand the impact? What seems to be the issue?
My gut is that it's just where software has evolved from, right? Not too long ago, although now it's been 15 plus years, like the UI on top of most web things was not great, right? It was just slapped together with some HTML and CSS. And that was, you put some forms and fields, but the web didn't look that great. And it came from a very engineering first background. And I think that's still just a lagging effect that the world is compensating for, where the builders, right, which currently people think of that as engineers, they get the most budget and they get the time. So a CTO can say, hey, I need 50 or X number of engineers. And it's just lagging on people not realizing that the UI UX piece of that is a builder. It's just as important in understanding the right problem, right? So, and their efficiencies will drive so much better code and architecture and throughput through the engineering teams. So I talked to a lot of CTOs about, dude, if you're asking for 10 or 15 or 20 more engineers, give me back two or three of those headcount and put them into UI UX, right? Whether that's on your product team or I see a lot of UI UX teams roll up to a CTO, that's fine. But yeah, convert some of your headcount from true engineers to some form of product designer and you'll get more throughput. Like you will get less, you'll get more and it'll be better and more valuable quality.
Is that the pitch usually you make? Because I find a lot of people are like, we can't quite quantify or justify the return on a designer. Because it is a little bit more creative and it is, you hear that a lot. Yeah. And is there?
Oh, totally. The pitch I make is if you're about to build a house and you want to send a bunch of framers, plumbers, electricians out to the job site and they get there and there's no plans and it's just a bunch of materials and you get and just say, go, right? Start building the house. And what are they going to do? They're just throwing stuff together. You give them great blueprints with this beautifully architected house, which is basically the designer, right, role. And it meets the needs of the person that's going to move into the house. It looks beautiful. It's functional. It's all those great things. Then when all those people get there to build it, they're going to know what to do, how to do it. And then you're going to get this dream home that you want. So that's the analogy I make with CTOs. Yeah. And it starts to resonate, but it certainly takes a little while.
Do you see UX in designers having less of a home and more back-end type of products that don't necessarily have interfaces outside of APIs or something like that? And like, how do you communicate it in that context?
I would say generally, yes, that's true. If you're building an API platform, you could either make a case that you need less UX. Obviously, at that point, maybe you're not calling it UI, but I don't think that's entirely true. Yeah. Right. I think a UX professional that can go research the needs of the person that's going to use that technology, they'll still help the team drive out a better API, a better set of endpoints. Certainly then if we've built public APIs for companies and then you want it to service itself in API documentation, user guides, all those things. And that's where actually even a true UI UX professional that's let me think about this from something visually I see on how to implement this API. And it drives out still better results. It'll look and feel different than a true SaaS product, but it doesn't mean there's not a need there for sure. And they can absolutely add some good value in understanding the users and the customers of that API.
Yeah, I love that call out because I think that's typically where these leaders get that wrong is that they think of it as just graphic design. They think of it as just visual UI. And not the holistic practice of product design and the research and the use. Yeah, like you said, the industry is getting a little bit more mature and recognizing the value of it and seeing where it plugs and plays into things. But I don't think it's quite there yet. I wish it was more, but that's okay.
It's getting there. If anything, I do think
it's getting there.
They're on the right direction. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, I agree. Let's talk about iteratively shipping, and then I want to move on to another topic. But how does Crafted think about iteratively shipping products quickly?
This is becoming more and more important for us that we're teaching more clients. And whether it's greenfield, new product development, or you're modernizing or adding on to existing applications, we feel it's super important that as you build and ship those things, you can ship them incrementally, meaning shipping smaller portions of your feature set faster. And a lot of that, when it comes down to it, is, do I have the right feature toggles to allow me to do that? Can I segment to my users, if I do have enough users, that, hey, I only want to turn it on to 1%, or I want to turn it on for a certain segment. So things like Optimizely, Launch Darkly, really critical. You could hand roll some of your own kind of feature toggles and throttling mechanisms, but super important, because otherwise things just get, there's all these reasons why you can't ship yet, or too risky, or too whatever. So you got to de-risk that by saying, no, we can only launch this to one person if we want to, or one client at a time. So we're working with more and more clients to make that a critical piece of their kind of both infrastructure and their like requirements roadmap. Like a good product manager, I feel, should make sure that is a capability that you have, so that you don't have any blockers to releasing software. And then the other thing you mentioned in the UI UX, Kevin, is, do you design for the future vision and then let that degrade and only ship the MVP? But absolutely, in the journey, you have to make sure your UI UX can ship iteratively, right? You shouldn't have to build the entire feature. Like, what pieces of that journey can we chop out, ship still a good usable feature that'll make users happy, and then add on to it in the future? So it's part of a role of, again, all three disciplines to be really good at thinking about things in an iterative fashion. And then another key we're talking with a current client about is also making sure their business counterparts understand that iterative approach, right? If you're a marketer or a salesperson, and teaching them that they are better off if they allow us to ship small increments to different groups faster versus waiting till something bigger is ready. So there is a change management outside of product development that I think is also super key for that.
Absolutely. I wanted to talk a little bit more about that too, to add on the go-to-market function, right? Like how those two processes are evolving, how you've been seeing this with other companies. I'm sure other organizations have more of a handoff process, like you do your part, we'll do our part. Sometimes it's a little bit more embedded and collaborative. But there's a little bit of science and not specific things here. So how do those functions flow when you see it working well?
Big key to that, Kevin, is what you've seen evolve over the last several years. I don't know if it's 5 or 10 years old, but product marketing. So that's a new discipline that I think is really put in place to help bridge the gap between product development teams and their business counterparts and the go-to-market strategy. So that's evolved a lot. And I think it's come to some really good spots. We have a partner consultancy, Fluvio, launched by Devin O'Rourke, who's with, used to be with Amazon and some really great companies. And it's been a great fit with Crafted to help us get to market faster. And I think what's happening there is just really gelling the relationship, the communication, the collaboration between product development teams and those business counterparts, right? You want consistent communication. You want real, you got to be really transparent. I think the old school way of doing product development 20 years ago was like a black box. You always heard this black box analogy and nobody knew what was going on until something was ready. We want to break those down. And I think product marketing is helping that. And then also, once we ship things, we know from a product management standpoint, a historical problem has been, you never get to follow up on that thing. You never get to measure it. You never get to see what's working. And so I think with product marketing or good product management practices, you have more time and iterations to do that. Make sure, is it resonating with it, with the market? Is it starting to change the metrics that we want to change?
I'm glad that y'all are embracing that. And then the consultancy is really helping y'all work better in that area.
Yeah.
I feel like that is one of the areas, just like UI UX design, that is a little newer, trying to figure out how it operates. But I tend to agree with you. Like, we are headed in the right direction. A lot of these functions are going to be really helpful over the years. And when you see it working well, it's incredible. It's fun to be a part of.
Absolutely.
Let's shift topics a bit. Gluttony phase. So this kind of no more revenue multiples. We talked about EBITDA. We talked about hunkering down profitability. How is this going to change the way products are being built over the, you know, course of the next year or so?
I think it's an important good trend that's going to cause more kind of maturity and more efficiency and more focus. Like in product management, we always talk about focus and priority behind the scene, because we're getting thrown, you know, 50 initiatives and we don't have time or money to do all of them. So as a product manager, then it's your job to go sift through that and fight the tough battles, have the tough conversations. But now what's happening with the tighter economy and tighter funding, that's going up a level now to the C-suite, into the boards and things like that, to where they no longer have an abundance of cheap money So they can't just say, guys, what's the problem? We gave you a ton of money. Just go do all the things. Now it's up a level where they're now saying, oh man, yeah, maybe we got $100 million in funding, but we're not allowed to just burn it in 12 months to get growth. We have to be efficient with it. Instead of throwing 10 ideas out at the team, we need to whittle that down to 5 that we think are our best bets. And the other 5, we're not going to even try them because we don't have enough money or time. So we're going to focus more on where we spend our money. We have to be more methodical to make sure those bets are going to pan out. And then that trickles down to the hiring. Like, I think we've both seen where companies get big rounds of funding and they immediately go ask all their managers. They don't really ask them what the goals are and what the metrics are. The first thing that comes out after a round of funding is, give me your spreadsheet with what headcount you need. And it's just like everybody raises their hand and everybody needs 10 or 20 people. And that's where I think we've seen this blow during the pandemic, maybe pre-pandemic, that now unfortunately is correcting, because I know there's a lot of people that are temporarily out of job because of that. But I think a lot of it was due to just a little bit of irresponsibility of how we hire and bloat teams versus forcing efficiency and forcing focus and prioritization, which I think is a better way to use shareholders' money and or VC or private equity money. It's the smarter way to do it. It's not the easier way to do it, but I think we're going to see that trend. So now I think going into next year, it's going to be a lot of that focused roadmaps, really tight control of, hey, is that thing that we said we were going to do, is it going to provide the return that we hoped it did? So a lot more measurement and understanding and things like that.
Do you think it's going to manifest in more product maturity of the board and where they're placing their investments? Or is this going to happen in a little bit more of a fear of failure from the product and innovation teams? Are we going to see that type of a reaction?
Good question. I've never been on a board, so I can't say how they truly think, but I hope they will. And I think they will, to where they're going to take more inputs and realize, okay, if the team is telling us they can only do 5 things really well, one, let's listen to that. And instead of forcing them to do 10, let's take their word that we can do 5. And then I think some collaboration amongst the board, the C-suite, and the product development teams, I'm like, what proof and data do we have that's our best bet? And I know we've talked about being data-driven for a long time in the industry, but I do think there's now going to be a bigger and more focus on, do we actually have the data? Does it back up? Maybe hopefully more poking and prodding at that, like people asking critical questions of it. And maybe it'll go downstream into more iterative MVP approaches. I don't know if that'll come back as a reality or not, but I do. I hope it goes up to the board with just being a little bit more methodical on what they're asking their teams to do so that they can ensure that it drives value.
Do you think it'll ever correct back or boomerang, I guess, from that focus on EBITDA and profitability to revenue multiples and more growth?
I think it will. And I think things will get more aggressive, but hopefully this is one of those pendulum things where it doesn't swing too far back one way or the other. In all the conversations I've had lately, is there will, at least for now, and I think it'll stay, instead of only looking at the revenue multiples, the rule of 40, or now maybe some companies are more in the rule of 60. I think there now will always be at least a little more attention on EBITDA or profitability versus just, I was never a fan of the idea of just burn money and lose money. Like, I get, I'm too fully responsible for that. And so I hope that never fully goes away. I just think it's a bad way to run businesses. I don't believe in stepping up to the plate and swinging for the fences every single time. I don't know.
Right.
But I'm also not a VC or private equity guy, so I don't know.
That's great. Now you've been exposed a little bit. No, you're not on a board, but you've been exposed more to that world, right? And you're now a leader, you're now a CEO, you're now a founder. Tell me more about the challenging aspects of that transition and anything key learnings that you've had in your journey so far. I know it's early on, but
For me, 2 challenges. One was, when do I officially stop being a product manager or a part of a balanced team? Like, the first years of Crafted, I was absolutely still playing that role. It was phenomenal for efficiency and profitability and things like that. So for me, it was a challenge. Okay, you need to, if you really want to grow a business, you need to step into a CEO role and not be a product manager anymore. And I'd never want to fully lose that, because I do consider myself a technologist, but I had to get into that realm and I need to keep growing into that realm and whatnot. And then I think as you do that, are you doing enough to give the team any insights that you want to give them, but marry that up 50-50 with also letting them drive this stuff forward as well, right? You hire smart people, let them do their job. I want them to change what I've created with Crafted and something that'll be bigger and better. So it's that mix of teaching, coaching, educating, but also giving autonomy, letting the team build a company that they're also proud of and proud to be a part of. So learning kind of those things, but I enjoy it. I enjoy the transition. It's allowed me to really focus on learning a lot of other things, diving deep into sales and marketing and finance and stuff like that. So it's been a good way to not stagnate myself either. And I have challenges every day, but it's fun. I enjoy that side of it.
We're at the end of the year in 2023. And is there one key challenge that sticks out to you from the year that was a big moment for you, learning milestone, what have you?
I have to say this year, it was just the tightening of the economy and seeing the velocity of kind of decision-making slow down, which again, I'm on the flip side. I also just a minute ago said that's a good thing, prioritization and focus and more scrutiny. But for Crafted, that trickled down to us where if the ideal state is like you have less of that and people are just willing to spend more money easily. But I'm also saying it's the better thing for our clients to do is be more meticulous with their spend. And I'm seeing that come down with us where it is a lot more conversations. Instead of three, it's maybe five or six. It goes up and down the chain to C-levels and executives more, all the way to the board a couple more times. So that's been the challenging part of this year. And it's interesting that it's challenging at a time where the economy is doing pretty well, right? The only downside is that money is expensive. But that fear of money being expensive is enough to where it is slowing down decision-making and investment decisions. But we just need to stick with it. I think teams are going to realize that we still have to innovate, right? And that's some thoughts I'm putting out into the market is that while the cost of money is high, what is the opportunity cost of not innovating, right? And slowing your innovation pipeline. Like to me, that's a lot more than an interest rate going from 3% to 7%. That could be 10 or 20 or 30% loss on opportunity, right? So I'm hoping there's a kind of a spike in people realizing like, hey, we still have to innovate. And if we do it right, the returns more than compensate for the increased cost of capital.
As a leader now, with the type of work that you're doing, what are the success signals that you measure that are more leading indicators in your organization towards that forward momentum? Is there things, specific data elements that stick out to you?
Yeah, I think for Crafted, our main metric is always like existing clients and what are they happy with the value we're delivering and do they appreciate like what we're doing, but will it also turn the needle for them? Because I admit we'll have clients that they love working with Crafted, but what we need to do is make sure the software we're shipping with them also drives the business forward. Like they could still be happy with us and then the features we ship have a flat impact. At the end of the day, that's going to have a worse impact for them and for us. We also have to help drive them, ask hard questions, poke and prod our priorities to make sure that when we ship software for them, is this going to have a big spike in EBITDA for you or sales or customer acquisition or whatnot. So we always keep a close eye on current clients. And then the other indicator I'm looking at is just very much the sales pipeline and conversations, what I'm hearing with current leads and prospects about their budgets for next year. And I wouldn't say it's like up or down. I wouldn't say I'm super excited about what I'm hearing, but it's also not doomsday. Like we have plenty of conversations where indicators are like, yeah, we have budget to spend. We do still want to build and drive product value into the market. So I'm opportunistic there, but it certainly isn't like what it was a year or two ago or pre-COVID, stuff like that. Yeah, a mix of optimism and be cautious type of mindset.
I have two more questions for you, and then we'll jump into our homework and plugs and go from there. One of my last two, based on your experiences, your journeys, what advice would you give to aspiring product leaders who want to make this transition into a founder, or potentially like any type of advice for folks on the market today looking for their next opportunity?
I'll speak to people that want to perhaps go found something first. I think when I look back at both my journey as well as other successful founders that I've seen, whether it's in tech and SaaS or other industries, I found that usually the most common success stories I hear are when somebody deeply knows something that they're going to go found a company in. Right. So whether that's SaaS, but even if it's SaaS, it's like a domain that you know a lot about. If it's outside of tech, like you've worked in that industry, you've been on the front lines, you deeply know a lot of aspects about the domain plus how to operate that type of business. I've always seen those trend towards the best successes and the best chances of success. I've seen a few other scenarios where people just monitor something and they They're like, oh, I've heard this is a way to make money, or this seems like a neat industry. I should jump into it. Maybe it's like AI or ML or blockchain. People are like, hey, that seems like a trend. I should go jump in there and start something. In my mind, that's a really risky venture if you don't know a ton about the domain and the specialties. So I would focus people on, one, do something you're passionate about and that you know a lot about. Because then if you want to turn that into a business or a technology solution, you are your first domain expert and can help much faster get to some experiments, some proof points, some lean and iterative kind of releases. So I'd do that. And then as far as the job hunt side, I'll be honest, it's people need to stay aggressive. There's a lot out there, a lot of resumes coming in. I know there's a lot of people looking for jobs. So it's, I guess, number one advice is look for people in referrals and connections you can make, right? That's almost always going to get resumes to the top of the stack faster, or maybe even not on the stack. It gets you to bypass the stack of resumes and directly to somebody. So I'd say go mine your networks and direct connections that you can really leverage in a good way. And I think at least here in Colorado and probably most places, like when you ask somebody for help, there's a lot of people willing to give you help. There's a lot of people willing to make connections, especially if you back that up with being a great person and being an expert and knowing your stuff. So I'd say lean that way first before spraying and praying resumes all over job boards and stuff like that, because it's getting diluted with the number of people out there for sure.
All right, last question for you here. Given your experience and the current trends of what we discussed today and what you're seeing, where do you see the field of product development heading in the next 5 to 10 years?
Yeah. Man, 5 to 10 years. Holy cow. It's a good one. I don't often get enough time to sit and think about 5 to 10 years out. It's going to be pretty phenomenal. I think the amount of automation and what I've seen in the last 6 months to maybe 6 to 12, just with AI and ML coming up, has been the biggest leap in technology I've seen in my lifetime. It's unbelievable. It blows my mind and I'm in tech. So I can't really imagine how far that's going to go in the next 5 to 10 years. I think it's going to blow our mind. It'll get smarter and faster. So I think product and product development needs to realize, like, how can they add value to that while embracing it? Weed through anything that might be fake or troublesome with AI and add human value to it. So I think it'll be this heavy focus on human value and maybe staying connected with our technology as technology gets smarter. But I think there'll be a ton of stuff in experiences and visual kind of AI around us, and whether it's VR types of things. So I don't know. I'm excited to see it though. And I'm personally somebody that like embraces that. And it's not going to go away. So you might as well just get on board and go with it. But how can we certainly keep some guardrails around it? And I think product managers, product development teams are going to have to figure out where they can add big value on top of these things when some of that stuff is going to become more commoditized. But that's our next challenge, is still adding value on top of what we have.
Love it. Thanks, Adam. This has been great. Any homework you want to give to the listeners based on our conversation? What is one thing you can put into practice this week while you're listening to this show? Anything that comes to mind?
Get your list of reading going. Like, who are your thought leaders? Who are your experts? And devote a little bit of time to getting outside of your weeds. I think we all get overwhelmed with our day-to-day work. Take that time to do 15 to 30 minutes of reading, either in your space, maybe branch out and read something about finances or business or something you wouldn't normally read as well. But hone in on that list of who you want to learn from and then make it a priority to get out of your day-to-day grind a little bit.
I second that. Yeah. And then I think just building that craft wherever you can. So if it's either in the job or somewhere that you can do something on the side to just build that muscle, go through the exercise, write things down, approach problems, see what you can come up with just to keep your brain fresh and ways of looking at things. And so try some things like that. But Adam, is there anything you'd want our listeners to check out, or you want to promote Crafted specifically, or anything in particular?
Yeah, I'd say if you're interested in or needing product development help and iterative delivery of value, just go to www.crafted.solutions. Check us out, reach out on the website. We're in various Slack channels or LinkedIn. But find us, connect. We're happy to help. We're happy to give advice and just collaborate. And then long term, if you need some expertise, we'll jump in with you.
Thanks again, Adam. This has been great. Thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks, Kevin, for having me, man. Really appreciate it.
It looks like we finished up our coffee, so go level up.
This has been Product Coffee, produced and engineered by me, Kevin Gentry.
Through our podcast partner, Anchor, you can now record a voice message and send us ideas or topics to cover, and who knows, we might end up playing it on the show. You can also become a supporter of Product Coffee by contributing a monthly donation to help us sustain future episodes. Please rate, review, and subscribe to Product Coffee on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.